Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Little man!
short hiatus, fiasco. Yes. The power gets knocked out here in Kansas regularly. Our satellite uplink was shot to pieces yesterday. And still, you come back to listen. John Grant coming up. That was Arcade Fire. John Grant live here in the next few minutes. In the meanwhile, you'll have to put up with me. My name is Mike Adell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. And have a great day. Listen in.
Who can kill a general in his bed? Overthrow dictators is their red. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can buy a government so cheap? Change a cabinet without a squeak.
Fucking amen.
CIA man. Who can train gorillas by the dozens? Send them out to kill their untrained cousins. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can get a budget that's so great? Who will be the 51st state? Who has got the secret of safest? The one that makes the other safest neighbors. What's your name, man? CIA man. Who can take the sugar from its sack? Pour in LSD and put it back. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can mine the harbors, Nicaragua? Out hit all the hitmen of Chicago. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can be so overtly covert? Sometimes even covertly overt. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who's the agency well known to God? The one that copped his stamp and copped his rod. Fucking amen. CIA man. Fucking amen. CIA man. Fucking amen. CIA man. 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 CIA man
Oh, yeah. Let's listen to a little bit more of Joe Strummer and the Clash. Dearly departed Joe. We'll be remembering him for the next 15 minutes. Let's give Joe 15 more minutes before John Grant comes on.
For the playboy and the Cuban fun, for Castro the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets won Castro dead. Castro is the color. The bullet is a spray of lead.
entertainment. Cop-kicking gypsies on the pavement. Now the moon has left to attention. Noon, the landing of the Vince Convention. Italian monster, shoots a lobster. Super rich, drunk, gets out of hand. Car in the fridge, a bridge in the car. Like cowboys do in TV land.
You know what?
It's no good for man to work in cages. Hit the town, he drinks his wages. You're threatened, you're sweating. But did you notice? You ain't getting. You're threatened, you're sweating. But did you know you're not getting anywhere? Don't you ever stop long enough to start? Take your car out of that gear. Don't you ever stop long enough to start? Get your car out of that gear. Call them up, a fire at Engels. Came to the checkout at the 7-Eleven. Marks was good, but he had sense. Engels, Lenin, a necessary bend. What do we got? What do we got? Yeah. What do we got? Magnificent. What do we got? Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi went to the park to check on the game. They was murdered by the other team. Went on to win 50-0. You can be true, you can be false. You'll be given the same reward. Socrates, a Millhouse, and both with the same way through the kitchen. Plato the Greek. Or in Tintin. Who's more famous than a billion million? Boom, flash. Vacuum cleaner sucks up Budgie.
Listeners, he's still alive. He's still alive, listeners. And I'm still alive. Yes. One more from the Clash. And we'll have John Grant on in no time. Good morning, Kansas.
Yeah. of it was true.
Some recalling at the top of the dial, and after all this, won't you give me a smile? I never felt so much alike.
Joe Strummer and The Clash. I've been going through some decompression at 105 degrees yesterday here, John Grant.
Wow.
Are you there? But Yeah.
It's
hotter than hell.
105 degrees, that's amazing. Wow, jeez.
Yeah, we were on the cutting edge of a cold wave coming through, but it got really hot.
Hear it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's because you're John Grant.
Yeah, okay.
You can't handle
that. Well, listen, you know, I was just rereading a column by Paul Krugman on Kansas.
Yeah,
New York Times.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been trying to convince my fellow citizens that we are not lab rats. And, and
well,
great,
it's about your famous Governor Brownback's fiscal experiment 2 years ago to slash income taxes.
We're going through that, 105 degrees.
And apparently, according to Krugman, it's an absolute disaster. And, you know, it's not working the way it's supposed to be. And the Laffer curve, remember that he consulted Arthur Laffer for this. He's a leftover from the Reagan administration.
People don't know who the hell he is. I've tried to tell people here in Kansas who the hell he is. We paid him $75,000. Flew him in from God knows where, Tennessee or Kentucky, and he came in and laughed at us and said, yeah, give the billionaire Koch brothers a big hand job. And by the way, don't let them pay any taxes either, you know. And,
right.
That's what.
Well, it seems to be holding up Kansas's idea of what's his name's book, What's Wrong with Kansas? The people out there always are going along with things that are not good for them. Like, why would you want to this Laffer idea of
laughable
cutting taxes for the rich. It's supposed to improve the economy, as Krugman points out, is so discredited that it's just unbelievable that it can slip by in a place like that. You know, it's like kind of amazing that
the toxin is spreading, John Grant.
Yeah,
it spreads through. As Krugman pointed out in his article in the New York Times, which was really I don't think that was his regular column. It is spread through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Exactly.
And you see, you're whipping me in the line here in the morning. I wasn't ready for this, but, after a heat wave. I keep waiting. I'm watching the local television. I have a monitor going on. We've got standoff SWAT teams 30 miles from me, citizens in shorts and T-shirts walking out with their hands up, nonstop crime. I think it's a social Darwin. They want the poor to kill themselves off or work them to death for less than minimum wage. They'd like to not pay anybody anything. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't really care. They don't really care if there are any social services for the drug addicts or the sick.
They really
just want to put SWAT teams. There's a lot of cops and uniforms and machine guns out here. And if it's not the cop, it's the civilians. I mean, it's just one side or the other. I mean, the answer to everything is brutality. That's what it's all about, brutality.
What's the incident you're talking about that the cops are out today? Or
some standoff. It happens almost every day out here anymore. I'm 30 miles from me out in Topeka, Kansas. I'm as all my listeners know, broadcasting from North Jefferson County. We're smack dab between Kansas City, Kansas, Lawrence, the Blue Dot and Ocean of Red, Lawrence, Kansas, home of the University of Kansas, and Topeka, the state capital, all within 30, 40 miles of me. And it's every day, every day. There's some standoff, some there was a bomb threat at the Dollar General last weekend. Now, what kind of guy, what kind of person driven batshit crazy would call, would hoax a bomb threat at a Dollar General store?
I don't
think
know.
About
that,
that for a minute. Think about that.
Yeah. Unless, you know, he didn't like somebody at the Dollar General store.
Well, we could come up with all kinds of perambulations, but the fact of the matter is only an idiot would do that and then get caught. So, I mean, and I think he did it from a pay, or she did it from a payphone. How dare you charge me a dollar? I'm blowing your place up. And what do these mofos care? I mean, the people in the legislature, they've all left. You know, they passed all these damn laws in less than 90 days, and then they leave. They scatter like rats all over the state.
Well, you know, this isn't a racially issue, but it follows Michelle Michelle Alexander's that's her name, I think, new Jim Crow thesis. The idea that you know, her book, really fantastic book, is that all the, you know, the black folks in prison, it's that nowadays the rich, if you will, the established and all that, they have all these laws. And you can't focus on black people racially anymore because, you know, we've you know, the civil rights movement, history, and you can't do that anymore. So the, what happens is that there's all this effort of enforcement of laws, and you end up stigmatizing a lot of black people as felons, and so you accomplish in her argument the same thing that you used to do, you know, in the old Jim Crow. Now it's a new Jim Crow, where instead of being racially identified, you're now a felon. Well, I mean, that applies to the poor in general, as you're
right,
kind of
exactly.
Is that, you know, I mean, you get the poor so distraught and so stressed out because they can't make ends meet. They're doing this, they got to do that. And, you know, they have no job or whatever, this and that. And they get, their lives become very, very messy. And when lives become messy, they start breaking laws, and you start getting drunk and doing stupid things. And, you know, you can then corral people and get them under the criminal justice system and control them a lot more. And, you know, eventually, I suppose, a final solution, put them away somewhere, you know.
Well, that seems to be Governor Sammy's
comeback. Kansas may have that down to a real art, you know.
Oh, they do, believe me. It's. I couldn't even do a show yesterday. I missed the show, listeners. Over the weekend, I got the collector's edition of, you know, white middle class male, right? Got access a little. I only have a convicted felons are only some relatives of mine. You know what I mean? You know. They wanted to put some felonies on me, but they couldn't get away with it. But the truth of the matter is, my son and I watched Oliver Stone's Salvador, and I'm pushing that on you.
Fantastic.
Because the collector's edition, listeners, you really should get it. It's less than $15. It's like $12 or $10 through Amazon. You should really get it, listeners, because you know, for one thing, nobody remembers Salvador below my age. I've polled my neighbors. No, never heard of that one.
You mean the movie or the country?
The movie, Salvador,
yeah, right.
The movie. You know, they don't, people 30-somethings and 20-somethings do not know Salvador, the movie, by Oliver Stone, and you've got a tremendous opportunity. You got to get it through Amazon. I hate to run this ad for Amazon, but my son and I and my sweetheart, who's not, hasn't been here for a couple of days, that's probably what's wrong with me. I've been drinking since.
I'm
just totally fucked up lately because my sweetheart's gone, you know, and so we watched it.
You're missing your baby, man. God.
I miss my baby, and I got my son here. He holds it together for me. But, I mean, damn, I don't watch Salvador when you're, you know, your heart's breaking, you know what I mean? But watch it. Get this for one reason. There's an incredible 30-minute documentary in the special features section, and to hear Oliver Stone talk about how he pulled off. And you can turn on the commentary on the DVD and listen to him talk about how he pulled this movie off and what was going on. Why do I bring this up with what John Grant's talking about? I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because with Sam Brownback and Art Laffer dates back to the Reagan Empire, okay?
Right.
And Sam Brownback is the new Ronald Reagan for the right wing in Kansas, and I got news for you. He's more intelligent than Texas Governor Rick Perry, okay?
Well, I don't,
he's a very conniving, diabolical force. No. He is vying to be the contender. He's Ronald Reagan II coming at you in Pennsylvania and the world. Sam Brownback thinks he's Ronald Reagan II. And Salvador was right in there with Ronald Reagan. I would like you, John Grant, tell us about those Reagan days with Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras. Because I told my son, I said, imagine that. And my sweetheart, we were all watching. I said, imagine that. John Grant's been there. John Grant.
Well, I've
been
there, yeah, probably five times. Yeah, yeah.
We need to hear about those wonderful Reagan years and what that meant when that.
Right.
I think James Belushi in the movie Salvador, playing a character who was a disc jockey, which is all I am really fundamentally.
Right.
DJ Dr. Rock. Goes down to Salvador with Richard Boyle, a journalist, a real journalist, listeners.
Yeah, I've met him,
the
real man, yes, indeed.
Well, you're going to tell us about it a little bit. I'm derailing this whole thing. I know you want to read the New York Times, and we'll get back to the New York Times, but I want you to tell us this because it's so goddamn powerful what happened. You know, a million refugees, listeners, from Central America. You hear that gray-haired Obama upset. You're upset because the black guy in the White House is given once $2 billion to help the refugees coming up. You know, you get upset over this, you white listeners out there. You get upset.
Right.
You get worked up in a racist furor over Obama wanting money to handle this tsunami of humanity coming up from the South. Yeah. It's happened before, listeners. You know, and it happens. It happens regularly in our history.
Well, Central America is.
Tell us about it. Reagan and Salvador and Nicaragua and all this shit. My 20 and 30 something neighbors do not know, understand.
Well,
let me
go at it here because El Salvador and Central America was where the scales fell from my eyes, if you will. It wasn't Vietnam that came later. I was seeing things going on down there, and I taught myself photography. And I says, "What the hell? I'm going down there to find out myself, take some pictures, meet some people." So I must have made, six, seven, eight, nine—I forget how many anymore—trips to Nicaragua and El Salvador. I would go down for 2-3 weeks, and you know, was in the rebel zones, and you know, I photographed. El Masote, where the massacres were being taken apart by forensic anthropologists. I went to the morgue where the bodies and the bones of all these people, you know, and I did stories on all kinds of things down there. And El Salvador, of course, is the tiniest country, except Belize, but is the smallest country in Central America, but notably the most densely populated. And, of course, in 1932, there was a famous incident called La Matanza, which is the massacre in which the powers that be, which tended to operate this way in Central America, the 14 families, very powerful, they wanted the best land, and so they consistently threw native Indian types off their land throughout history and kept the best land for themselves for various crops, cotton, whatnot, and that the the subsistence farmers, poor, the peasants, were pushed to the worst possible land. And finally it came to a head in La Matanza, in which in a matter of days, 30,000 peasants who were at the time wearing Indian dress so they could be readily identified and slaughtered, 30,000 people were murdered in like a matter of weeks. And it's a very famous historical backdrop of Little El Salvador, because after that, the peasants never wore Indian garb ever again, like they do still in Mayan countries in Guatemala, which suffered its own horrors. So El Salvador has a unique history, and out of that, periodic reform moments happen, and during the 80s, one of those moments happened, that people were getting fed up. The liberation theologists, who were the Catholic priests and whatnot, were pushing for what they would call, the preferential option for the poor. In other words, the established church in Central America at that period was linked with the military and the politicians, and it would, theologically tell peasantry, oh, I know life is hard, and you're beleaguered with this and that, but do the right thing, be a good person, and when you die, you will go to heaven. Well, a lot of the people down there, and again, the liberation theologists, these people that said, no, in the Catholic Church, you don't have to wait until you die to go to heaven. You can remedy or seek remedy for your plight right now. And of course, that was one of the things that fed into this, civil war down there with the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front, the FMLN. And so there was a war that developed, with this guerrilla units. And my wife and I in 1986, made a trip up to Chalatenango, and it was actually Christmas, and they had at a village way up in Chalatenango, the guerrillas came down, and they celebrated Christmas there. They were, there was dancing. My wife was dancing with guerrillas, and it was this is the sort of world that developed in the 80s with the schism between the peasantry and the FMLN and the 14 families and the powerful elements of El Salvador. And of course Ronald Reagan then weighed in, and we supported the rich and the powerful against the peasantry. And ultimately that war, as horrible as it was, ended up in a stalemate. And in the FMLN became a political party. I went down and observed one of the elections in which they were running in the elections. It was very interesting. I was there in 2010 for the inauguration of Mauricio Funes, who is a TV reporter who ran for president and won as an FMLN candidate. And there's a new president now, a second FMLN president in El Salvador.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. But unfortunately...
Well, now, wait, well, let's back up, because it's...
Sure.
Now, what happened to... because we're... I'm going to drag Americans, our American listeners, especially our listeners in Kansas, back to this period in 1980, Ronald Reagan,
right,
the free market man, who's a special National Council Economic Advisor, was Art Laffer, who is...
Right.
We paid you, Kansans, paid $75,000 to and flew him in for his plane ticket.
Right.
He's been out here to advise Brownback on the great failed experiment in the economy here of the throwing everything to the free market. The Koch brothers, the rich, 13% in the state of Kansas did not pay any income taxes, and that's not counting the poor. That's the
so
rich.
So he needs to tweak it a little bit.
he tweaked it. Yeah, tweaked it to a point of catastrophe, as Paul Krugman has written in the New York Times, listeners. 1980, spinning off of the movie DVD Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it true, John Grant,
mm-hmm.
that there were bodies being regularly deposited in landfills? And how did
right,
these death squads operate?
Horrible.
And where
oh,
is
well,
Major Max? Major
up.
Max is Major Max in the movie is a reference to Colonel Bob. Or Roberto Dombisson. Where is
Dobisson.
Roberto Dombisson?
I actually photographed Roberto Dombisson once. Yeah. Roberto Dombisson, he was nicknamed Blowtorch Bob because he would torture people with a blowtorch. He was a notorious psychopathic leader of the. I judge him a psychopath, but he was a very, very violent man, Roberto Dombisson, and he died of cancer, and he led the effort of the death squads, which were paramilitary elements, certainly supported by the government, the Arena government, which was the party at the time, right-wing party, and the death squads at the height of it would have been the early 80s. There were every morning 65 bodies in the street or something, and they would find bodies in body dumps and garbage dumps. When we were there, there was a woman I'll never forget. I have a picture of her in my house right now, who was informing these gringos of her story, and her story was that her daughter had been disappeared, and she went looking for her daughter. And what people did at the time, you went to the body dumps to look for people to see if someone had found her. And there were books of photographs where people would take photographs of these bodies so people could come and look and say, oh, that's my aunt. Yes, okay, that's where it happened to her. Well, she found her daughter, and her body in her 20s, a daughter, she had been skinned. You know, that they had flayed her skin off in various places. And it was like to listen to this woman telling a story like that. And she was not making this up, trust me. But she wanted, and she was connected to a group. Her point was that North Americans need to know this stuff. You know, that this is the sensibility and the environment of the forces that you are supporting down here as the United States. You know, these people, there's an element of monsters in this movement to suppress the poor. The violence was horrible in those days. Unfathomable to many Americans, the kind of violence we're talking about.
This documentary special features on the DVD Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
There's a live interview with a guy who was called in the movie. It was Ambassador Kelly, but this is
mm-hmm.
they had this gray haired guy on mm-hmm. on the special features. His real name, I guess, is Ambassador White.
Oh yeah, he's a good guy. Yeah.
Would you tell us, because he was trying in a very liberal, neoliberal way. I don't know what happened. I mean, explain. There's a Reagan.
Well,
I forget
his first name, unfortunately, right now. But White, yeah, White is a good guy. He again, the scales fell from his eyes. He was ambassador, U.S. ambassador to El Salvador. I forget exactly the dates, but it got to the point that he just could not sustain it anymore, and he turned and he said, no, this is outrageous, the kinds of things that we're supporting down here. And, you know, he was no longer ambassador at that time. But El Salvador, the experiences there were horrible. But as I say, the irony of all this is that the FMLN, the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front, movement, I guess it's called, it is now an official party, like the Democrats or the Republicans, and it has a president now. It's a sitting president who is an FMLN party member. Now, does that mean there's this wonderful progressive state now in El Salvador? Of course not. The place is still as corrupt and as it was before, fortunately not as violent, although there are gangs and there's criminal violence and there's murder rates that are just outrageous down in a place like that. And, you know, they do the best they can, the FMLN leaders, because they're like our president here, who's a liberal, started out as an anti-war activist, of course, bizarrely. You know, you can't be president of the United States and somehow be a peacenik and a progressive person. You're stuck with the military industrial complex, and it will eat you alive if you don't graciously heed it. Well, the same way, even in spades, in a place like El Salvador, you know, you have an FMLN president, but his power is limited to the reality of real political power in a place like El Salvador. And, of course, you can then move around Central America to Honduras, which is the basket case of Central America or the Western Hemisphere. It often vies with Haiti, which is the worst. And, of course, it had a coup in 2010 in which they threw out the president. And the United States was just fine with that and went along with the coup government. And the murder rate has gone up there because the right-wing violence was given a sort of imprimatur of it's okay. And, you know, there's more right-wing violence than before the coup. And the United States is just fine with that.
Well, these people, this is not ancient history, but to talk to
our 20 and... No, this is going on right now. Well, of course,
I'm just telling you, Reagan is not ancient history. Here in Kansas, we have Reagan II in the form of Governor Sam Brownback. This guy is hallucinating, thinking he's hiring the same economic cronies that Paul Krugman wrote about in the New York Times, Art Laffer and others, not just Art, $75,000 down the tubes for that guy. And look what it's got us. And this guy, I mean, I'm just thinking, the only thing Sam Brownback lacks is Latin America. You know, I mean, I'm just so sick of it.
The Arena Party in El Salvador.
There's everything but death squads yet here. I mean, this abortion issue is going about to explode. Reproductive rights for women in Kansas is about to explode into another civil problem, and Brownback's taking his blower and stoking the flames, as well as half of these old decrepit Fox News addicts. You know, they're stoking the flames, pouring oxygen into the coals over women's reproductive health care rights. With the Supreme Court ruling the last week, we've heard about it's not just Hobby Lobby, listeners. It's worse than that, you know. I just see real division, social divisions. I see real animosity among the people, and I see these pigs on top, pillaging and making money. It's the '80s, Ronald Reagan in Kansas. I'm telling you, and
Ronald Reagan's art, his talent was to speak in this all gosh gee golly sort of way, and enamor, you know, ingratiate himself to a significant element of the American people, at the same time that he was like a walking euphemism. He got away with all this restructuring of the economy, and you know, and the economy that was bellied up some years ago, you could trace back to the actions of a Ronald Reagan. These people who advocate for the rich at the same time that they would make you believe they're connected to the people and they're so folksy and all this kind of
crap.
But really, what they're doing is they're it's like the con man or the three card Molly guy, and where's the P under what thimble? You're trying to figure it out, and by the time you figured it out, your wallet's gone. Yeah, these people are people who said that Ronald Reagan was stupid. I always say, whoa, you have no idea how brilliant that man was, that he could pull off this charade, this con, and over the American people. I mean, he was an actor, and he used that. And, he may not have been a Harvard PhD or something, but he had in Howard Gardner's psychologist sense of that there are many kinds of intelligences, this sort of soap selling intelligence, if you will. He was brilliant at it, and of course, he's the icon that all people like Brownback hold up as the great communicator, I think they call him. Well, no shit, he was a great communicator, all right. The same way as some guy selling you the Brooklyn Bridge was,
he's an iconic
American political character, and they're all trying to, mention his name and become again, like you said.
Oh, yes. The 1980s, I mean, there's so many people have either brain dead with Alzheimer's, their brains full of wormholes that they can't remember, or they've had these delusions about what it was like in the 1980s. They're all white.
Yeah,
all of
yeah,
them are
yeah.
white, and I mean they have no, and the young ones have no memory of this other than Iraq,
right.
The wars in Iraq.
Historical memory is something the Americans are not good at. We like to forget. It's convenient to forget, and then we run up the flag again and do the same goddamn thing we did before. It's an American pattern, not just American.
Well, we got a guy with his hand up. The switchboard, by the way, listeners, it's 646-716-8652. And no, you will not get on until I screen you. But I happen to know this guy. His name is what's your name, Brian from Pennsylvania? Brian Lawless is what I call him. Brian. Good morning, Brian. We're talking about. I tried to jumpstart John Grant about the Oliver Stone movie Salvador, because it's out in DVD very cheap, and it's got these tremendous, historically accurate special features on it that you can watch, and you see the bodies in the landfills, you see Ronald Reagan, I keep hallucinating and seeing Governor Sam Brownback on this. I'm just telling you. Good morning, Brian. Let's try to keep it on the subject of Let It Be, capitalism and the results thereof, and good morning. And it's the microphone.
Brian,
yours,
hey, good
gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, John. Always a pleasure, and thanks for sharing your time with me.
Yeah. So how you doing, Brian? What's up?
Well, that was a very, very interesting conversation that you've been having, and I'll try to stay on point here, but I'm no fan of Obama. I've never liked him. I've always felt he's a bit of a Manchurian candidate. I think it's reached a point with Obama where he's been far surpassed in terms, and Webster Carpley's talked about this, but he's been far surpassed in terms of evil by the John Kerrys, by the Samantha Powers, by the Victoria Nulands, the Dick Cheneys, the Paul Wolfowitz, McCain, etc. And I think
the rogue gallery there, boy.
With Reagan, I think you have to put it in the same context.
Right.
I think Reagan was an establishment Republican all the way, but unfortunately, over the years, he's been far surpassed in evil by the George Bushes in terms of the And if you want to talk about deregulation to the economy, he was far surpassed in terms of deregulating the economy, but Bill Clinton and George Bush. So you have to put these things in context.
I don't disagree with that.
Most of the deregulation that took place happened after Reagan left office. Reagan did not deregulate the banking sector, the telecommunications sector. He did not, you know, pass NAFTA and all these trade agreements and put America into the World Trade Organization. He certainly talked about those things, and he had people like David Stockman around him who were, you know,
right,
insane social engineers.
Who's completely disowned everything he said, you know. David Stockman.
Yeah, but then I've read part of his book, and it's basically, you know, he basically calls for things like abolishing the minimum wage, radical budget cuts, the same types of things that he was promoting under Reagan. So he may have a little bit of a more nuanced view in terms of banking regulation, but on the whole, I mean, he's still calling for the same things he was calling for 30 years ago. And he was critical of the Reagan administration for things like putting import quotas on Japanese cars. He was a free trade, you know, free market ideologue. And that's still what we have today. And my problem is, for example, with Consortium News, it's not Robert Perry's criticisms of Reagan, because most of them are valid, and a lot of the criticisms of that the administration in Latin America are very valid, but it's not seeing the bigger picture and understanding. You know, you can look at the 1980s, you know, Reagan did nothing to address the growing problems of offshoring and the damaging effects of trade. He did nothing to, you know, put in place these corporate raiders and hedge funds, which were extremely damaging. On the other hand, Reagan inherited, you know, a decade of stagflation. So you can say it started in the 80s. My argument's always been it started in the early 70s with the end of the gold window under Bretton Woods with Nixon, with the emerging trade deficits, these things into perspective.
Well, I think the United States is on a, frankly, this, I've come to this conclusion, it's on a, I mean, it's a tragic arc, you know, the rise and fall of an imperial entity, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
You can trace our current problems, you know, way, way back. I happen to think Jimmy Carter was, you know, he was inept in some ways, I guess, but at the same time, I think he was treated a bit unfairly. At the same time, when Reagan came in, he made a major shift on things, and you know, a lot of the debt problems and all that kind of stuff, I think it was really jacked up under Ronald Reagan. That we improved the economy by living more on credit. Although he wasn't supposed to be a I'm trying to think of the economist. You know, where you encourage debt, but he did it with the military. Of course, he busted the Soviets by jacking up all our military with huge amounts of money that the Soviets couldn't compete with, and so therefore they went belly up. And of course, he's famous for this. But a lot of the deficit idea of deficit spending, I mean, he, in my understanding, was instrumental in a lot of that. Now, whether he oversaw all this deregulation, he certainly encouraged it rhetorically, and over time, as I think, as you say, that even the Clintons fell in line with the course correction, if you will, that Ronald Reagan put on the nation after he was elected in 1980. I don't disagree with what you're saying. So,
I mean
they're all bad. I agree with you.
I guess the way I look at it is that New Deal Coalition broke up starting in the late 60s, and from what I've read in history in America, I think America functioned. I mean, look, you're never going to find a perfect time where everything was great, but I think America functioned at a pretty high level when you had the Democratic Party with one philosophy under the New Deal through the New Frontier, and you had the Republicans with an opposing ideology, and they kind of balanced each other out. But with the breakup of the New Deal coalition in the late 60s and the Democrats embracing neoliberalism, there was no contrasting force. You know, it's I think the whole system was worked best when you had two different political parties with two different ideologies kind of keeping
right.
each other in line. Now today, even though the country's divided in a lot of ways, if you always look on the critical issues, the critical life and death issues related to the economy and foreign policy, there's a large consensus. That's not to say that there aren't outliers and people that offer different ideas, but there's been a broad consensus that I would argue emerged not during the 80s, although there certainly was an emerging although there was quite a bit of a consensus then, but I think that started in the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, I think with the death of Robert Kennedy, you had the death of the last really traditional Democrat that was going to fight for those bread-and-butter issues like Social Security and Medicare and all these those other things that over the years have been replaced with more concern with things like the environment, abortion, and other social issues.
Well,
so,
Well, thinking about what you're talking about, it just kept coming back to me, sort of this big, the Vietnam War. It seems to me, maybe this is, I guess, a particular pet subject of mine, but it seems to me the amazing outlay of resources and treasure and all that at the time to prosecute the Vietnam War as it got worse and worse with protests in the street and all that kind of stuff, that really, we probably don't even recognize the profundity of polarization that created in this culture. It's just, to this day, it just continues to fester, and so we're now culturally polarized. At the same time, the economy, of course, was rolling. The economy was doing extremely well in the 60s. I mean, we were still, on this, high after World War II, and
definitely.
We could do no wrong, and things like Vietnam, we helped bust the bank and divide the country. Again, that's my particular topic, but it just seems like a large, huge, looming thing when you think about all this.
I don't think we ever learned anything from that war. I mean, I think the one thing that's true of history is that nobody ever learns anything from
it. We learned two lessons, and each polarized side has their own lesson, and they're blockheaded, even the left, And so there's no synthesis here possible because, what the right learned, the militarist right, if you will, learned is that you don't allow the press to run rampant in a war. You instill a rigid regime of secrecy, which we see now the results of that. It's become so outrageous. And so the right learned that, the military has to be stronger and we have to be more lightning fast and more brilliant and brutal. And, when we do something and we have to have our intelligence better. So what the right and the militarist right learned was to make war better. And the way to make war better was to make it more secret, of course. At the same time that the left learned its lesson was, you don't get involved in sort of quixotic episodes like this, sort of winless wars that you can't win with a third world country. And of course, the left would say, we didn't learn that at all. We went into Iraq and Afghanistan in ways that, I think it's interesting. You could look at the way the army that we trained in Iraq collapsed when they were hit with a sort of a homegrown furious force that felt righteous in Anbar province and whatnot in Iraq, that the Iraqi army just absolutely collapsed, analogous to the Arvin army that collapsed when finally we left, and they went down like to not want to confuse things with a mixed metaphor, but they went down like dominoes, you know. And, you know, so what did, as I say, you know, the right and the left learn different things, and they're completely polarized lessons. And, you know, we all are now fighting over those lessons. We're not fighting over the war anymore. We're just fighting over what lesson we've learned.
There is no left. There is no left.
I
just want to throw that in the microphone.
Decimated, yeah.
There is no left. And Reagan was a straight man to a chimpanzee. And I'm trying to inflame Brian right now because I'm just I've been screening callers. You're not going to get through. You know, you're not going to get through with your act. So
what? You have lunatic callers online, and you're not letting.
I feel like a communist small C Custer, General Armstrong Custer, out here in Kansas, surrounded by, instead of Indians, I'm surrounded by brain dead Fox News addicts. And I'll get back. I'm going to go back to the green room and screen more callers. But there is no left. There is no left. And, Brian, quit trying to beat a dead horse, okay? I'll see you later.
Oh, boy, that's provocative. Huh?
But, you know, John, one of the interesting things is when I listen to radio shows, every so often when I hear somebody talk about the Vietnam War, you know, I still hear people to this day say, you know, well, the problem with the Vietnam War was we didn't fight the war correctly. We didn't bring it to the Vietnamese. We had too many unprecedented rules of engagement. I always think, you know, I doubt the Japanese during World War II had a lot of rules of engagement. I doubt the French did, and they both lost, and they got involved in the Civil War.
Well, there's rules of engagement, and then there's history. I mean, my favorite is William Polk, who was he worked in the Kennedy administration, and he was a specialist in counterinsurgency war. He's a specialist in Algeria and in the French and Vietnam, and he advised them, like, hey, this is a quagmire. This is early on in the Kennedy. You're going to get stuck in this. It's outrageous. You should never go in. Well, he eventually he didn't stick around because they didn't pay attention to him. But he wrote this wonderful little book called Violent Politics, in which he surveys throughout history this idea of counterinsurgency, you know, the wars like Vietnam, like colonial wars like Algeria, and even he gets into Iraq. And he makes this absolutely right-on statement that says that the only really successful counterinsurgency war effort was done by the Romans. And they were successful because they employed absolute scorched earth. In other words, slaughter everything biological. And, you know, you will win. They will go along. Whoever's left will go along with you because you used such brutal, genocidal tactics. Well, the United States has an image issue. We can't do that. And so we therefore have exactly the problem that you talked about, rules of engagement. You know, like in Iraq, our rules of engagement, I remember arguing about was in some conference I had with a military guy that, well, the rules of engagement in Iraq says that, you know, if there was gunfire from a building, you could open up and completely level that building. Well, that's a pretty loose. I mean, you can't argue with that, I suppose, from a war making point of view. I mean, you could just obliterate the building, but then, you know, you couldn't then go on and just flatten and obliterate the entire neighborhood. There was a limit, you know. And
but there should be limits, or you'd end up with genocide.
Well, that's
no.
what I'm saying. But Polk's point is, if you're going to get into this business of counterinsurgency, in other words, go into somebody's hometown and say, no, 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 you don't get to decide what we do here. We, from 12,000 miles away, we're going to decide how you operate your town here. Well, if you're going to do that, based purely on military prowess and power, you know, you better either go all the way, like the Romans did, or you're going to end up halfway, and it's going to be unsatisfying, and you're going to have to leave with your tail between your legs. And then eventually the remnants that are so pissed off are going to come back and sweep the country like they did in Vietnam and like they're doing to a certain degree in Iraq right now. You know, this, you know, counterinsurgency war is a terrible and nasty business. And we, you know, even the whole effort of counterinsurgency war with Petraeus and what's his name, this Major Nagel, who's now out of the theorizing war business, is now the headmaster of Haverford School here, where a friend of mine works. It's the counterinsurgency effort in 2008 and all that period completely fell away because they realized it was too expensive to do all this humanitarian stuff and nation building and all that. So they then went to the other idea of counterterrorism, in which you base on intelligence and focused killing. And that's where we are now in that whole business. But it's failed in Iraq, and it's backfired completely on the people that the Bush administration who mounted that war.
I think what I've come to really understand about the Middle East and from listening to Webster Tarpley is that, you know, I think you basically have two choices in the Middle East, and they're not perfect choices, but you basically have the choice of a nation state with an authoritarian leader who's going to provide some kind of basic standard of living, not what we want here, or you overthrow that authoritarian leader. And instead of the nation state, you have chaos and a lower standard of living. So if you have a choice between Hussein, Assad, guy in Gaddafi, and all the rest of them, or the breakup of a nation state and chaos, I'm going to choose Hussein. I'm going to choose Gaddafi. I'm going to choose Assad. And, you know, to me, one of the things I look at is...
If you, follow Naomi Klein's idea of the shock doctrine, a very interesting book with a very interesting thesis, based on William Friedman or whatever his name was. What they did in Iraq was exactly the shock doctrine. They went in shock and awe, and they blasted the place. They disbanded the army. They disbanded the Ba'ath Party. They made it outlawed it. And they thought they were going to create a capitalist paradise here for some reason, or a democratic capitalist paradise. You know, they were delusional.
I don't think they really even had
that
intention.
They created exactly the chaos and fragmentation that you're talking about, which of course doesn't disempower. It disempowered Saddam's power based on oil. I mean, they were terrified of this man's power because of his control of oil in Iraq, and so, you know, they've solved that problem. But again, they opened a Pandora's box that I would argue is even worse.
Well, John, if I just may real quick, and then I'd like to get your thoughts. But I look at that a little different. I think a couple of the problems with Hussein were one, that he was threatening to dump the dollar, to trade oil for currencies other than in the dollar. And the power of the New World Order, American Empire, hegemony,
you
can't have that if you don't have the dollar as the world reserve currency. And the other was, they didn't like that he was pumping out too much oil, which meant oil prices were lower because we've had less oil coming out of Iraq since the war in Iraq.
That's kind of what I'm saying about his power from oil. But anyway, go ahead.
And I think they could have cared less whether the replacement was democratic capitalism. I just think they wanted a Western puppet. And what I think they've gotten mad with Maliki over the last couple of years is that he's more closely allied to Iran than to the United States, even though this is the guy we put into power. So what you have now is you have Putin sending fighter planes over to help Maliki fight ISIS. And you have the United States, who never hesitates to get involved in any kind of war or military action, not sending over planes. And then you have articles in the Washington Times saying that the ISIS is trained by the CIA at a secret base in Jordan, and they want to put a Western puppet in place. So I never bought into the whole nation-building thing. I think that was propaganda and publicity. I think the goal was break up nation-states with authoritarian leaders, yes, but nation-states that were not aligned closely enough to Washington, because Washington mm-hmm. wants world hegemony and, you know, subservience to Wall Street. And so I think that was the problem with Hussein. Bad as he was, and he was a bad guy. I mean, I think it's important to always...
Well,
Excuse me, listeners. Yeah. Grant and Brian, can you give us another 15 minutes? We're in overtime, and the switchboard is closed. I'm so glad to report. The switchboard, do not call in anymore, listeners.
Uh-huh.
Close. We're running into overtime. Could you give us another 15 minutes, Brian? And
sure.
John's okay with that?
Yeah. Well, you know.
Go ahead.
I think we can argue these details, but I think we're basically saying pretty much the same thing. I think that what we have now in Iraq is an absolute chaotic situation, and under Saddam, whether you liked him or not, you know, there was stability. I mean, when I was in Iraq, I had people tell me that, you know, under Saddam, you had to be very careful you didn't weigh into political things, but if you left the politics out of it, you know, that you could go about your business, you could make money, you could do business, you could do this, you could do that, and that there was stability in the culture. And in fact, in the 70s and 80s and I guess into the 90s, you know, Iraq was sort of headed towards a kind of a very serious, maybe first world status. I mean, its economy was doing well, I understand, and there's tremendous amounts of intelligent, educated people in Iraq. This is something, you know, we didn't allow for. It's like when I was there, the complaints from the Iraqis was, you know, we can build these buildings and we can do X, Y, Z. You don't need to come all the way over here and take it over and do it yourself. You know, we're quite capable of doing a lot of these very sophisticated things, but we wouldn't trust the Iraqis to do it. We had to do it ourselves. And of course, that's one of our fatal flaws, that, you know, we don't actually respect local genius and things like that. Now on the front page, get back to here to my thing here in the morning, New York Times front page, they're now talking about Ahmad Chalabi as the new prime minister of Iraq, you know, a replacement for Maliki, because everybody, a lot of people are all upset at Maliki. So now we're talking about, remember, Ahmad Chalabi. He was the guy with curveball and all this lying fictions and nonsense that he sold the Bush administration. They wanted to be sold, and he was going to be their propped-up prime minister, almost like out of the 1954 coup in Guatemala. It was almost going to be the overthrow Arbenz and put in this guy Armas, you know. I mean, it was, they were almost thinking of it in those simplistic terms. Well, of course, he then turned out to be a no-goodnik, and in fact, at one point in 07, I think it was, the United States military ransacked his house looking for evidence that he was connected to Iran, which, of course, he was the whole time, you know. And he's back, you know. It's like the return of a vampire or something. And you know, that's where Iraq is. It's pretty depressing to read about it all.
Well, and I think I mean, I really can't disagree with that. I guess I the things that I would add were that my conclusion again with Iraq and with what's going on in the Ukraine, Libya, all these other countries, is that they never had an intention to, you know, overthrow these. These leaders are essentially authoritarian dictators, but they never had an intention of trying to overthrow these dictators and put in somebody else who would deliver the goods economically for the people and offer something better economically. The goal was just to put in place puppets. I mean, like, for example, in Ukraine, they don't care if Poroshenko, the chocolate king, if their standard of living, the standard of living in the Ukrainians is cut in half. They just care that it's a puppet that's going to be allied closely with Washington, multinational corporations and banks. And that's what the Middle East is. Now, where they screwed up was they weren't counting on the fact that Maliki was going to be allied closely, closer with Iran. That's where they screwed up. They don't care. That
Well, that's because they had a much better deal under Hussein than they have now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And where they screwed up.
I mean, they should have
that,
known that, you know.
But you know, but that's like their arrogance. And the other thing I would add, too, is that they don't mind chaos. They look at it as if we break up a nation state with an authoritarian dictator who's more closely aligned with Russia and China or some other, you know, world power and who's independent. And if we depose that leader and break up that nation state and there's chaos, Washington looks at it as that makes us stronger. Of course,
Naomi Klein's shock doctrine thesis, absolutely. Yeah.
But the danger of that is that, you know, events can take on a life of their own and spiral out of control. And if things lead to a nuclear war, nobody wins. It doesn't matter if you live in a mansion behind a gate with security guards, you know, in New York somewhere. I mean, everybody loses. And that's, for example, the danger with the Ukraine. Things can spiral out of control. But one of the things I would say is that when I hear critics of, not you, but some of the critics of American foreign policy who are liberal say that, well, this proves that, you know, American capitalism doesn't work and nation, you know. No, the point was never to try to install capitalism. It was to put in place a puppet that would be allied closely with Washington's interests. Now, look at Ukraine.
Well, I would agree with that, but I would add this, that you look at exactly what you're saying. And you look at the Vietnam War, you look at Iraq, and you look at Afghanistan, is that all of that American, you know, power and capitalism and all of that richness, a lot of it now, vis-a-vis the rest of the world, has been squandered by things like Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, that we pissed away a lot of our power, and that our our shock and awe is not so shocking and awing anymore. You know, there was people look at us and say, oh yeah, you can kill people, but you know, in the end there's something lacking there, and the Americans are now, I think, suffering from this, especially as, you know, this is all part of a long arc of U.S. decline, you know, that probably started after World War II. We were on the height, but, you know, we could go nowhere but down. But it's slow. It takes a long, long time. U.S. is very powerful. At the same time, now we have the rise of the rest. You know, we have China, Brazil, Russia, everybody coming back as a capitalist power. So what the U.S. used to be, this hyperpower that, you know, could, back in 2003, you know, with Tommy Franks, consider that, you know, shock and awe, we would go into a place and they would just fall in line at our magnificence, you know, the presence of our power, and they would, it would just, you know, the girls would be throwing flowers at us, and, you know, it was... I think, completely squandered. So now, you know, we're just, you know, another huge power in the world. We're no longer this magic place. But
John, the silver lining could be that, you know, if these BRICS do form a closer alliance, which realistically, Paul Craig Roberts talked about this, he says, they really should have done this much sooner. He can't understand why they didn't. But, I mean,
The BRIC powers you're talking about?
The BRIC powers. But, I mean, if Russia and China, and let's say India with the nationalist they have in power, I mean, if they do, in fact, provide a counterbalance, it won't be better for Washington and Wall Street. Certainly it won't be better for them. but it could be much better for America as a whole. Because
I agree completely with that. That's why I say, you know, with a little bit of, you know, responsible downsizing of its empire and recognizing that the United States needs to start working in its own homeland to, you know, improve things like infrastructure, education,
yep,
for the future and all that, you know, by downsizing and having a little humility at the moment in the world, we would be a much more powerful entity in the future. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think that would assure America's survival. I mean, along
yeah,
with
yeah, yeah, but,
an
it, but, it, but it, that's why I say we're on this tragic arc, because, you know, with elements like the Republicans and Mr. Brownback and McCain and, you know, hosts of others, they're not going to let that happen. They're going to go down thinking they're the, you know, that their waste does not stink and they're exceptional and the world is just waiting for us to, you know, bomb them or something, you know, that it's like trying to inject humility into the process is difficult to impossible.
But yeah, yeah, no, I
since
think
we're talking
true.
About Kansas here, you know.
but I think the thing is, what I've noticed is as our fortunes have declined, these hegemons, they've tried to tighten their grip that much more. Instead
of
thinking, maybe, like you said, maybe we should scale things back, they've become more militant and more aggressive. Ukraine, Iraq, Syria, obviously Iran's always part of that. I just hope they don't blow up the tower and they get the world blown up in the process.
That's always hanging over us like a sword of Damocles, I guess, yes.
Right,
they could just blow the whole
point,
bloody thing up. You know?
My hope at this point is that Russia and China really try to foster a closer alliance, and I would hope that India gets involved in it too. And my hope is that they do start to move away from the dollar. I hope they don't move away from it entirely, but they move away to it enough that these neocons and humanitarian liberal interventionists, that they're totally discredited, and then we can start over and try something new, maybe try to bring America back closer to what it was 40, 50 years ago, hopefully having learned what worked and what failed 40, 50 years ago, so that you can offer a better alternative.
You say 50 years ago, after World War II, you know, with the highway structure and all the investments in education of returning soldiers, et cetera, to blah, 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 you know, that there was a bottom-up strengthening of you know, America and the homeland. I mean, it wasn't this financial manipulation kind of based, the top-down rich guy, Koch brothers idea of America as, you know, this top-down thing. And, you know, that's, to me, that's the struggle we're in here. And, you know, how do we empower more people in the United States.
Capitalism instead of financial capital. I mean, the problem is, like you said,
make
these
something.
Hegemons,
well,
they love derivatives, they love financial trading, flash trading.
Yeah, yeah.
They
well,
hate
you know, now,
manufacturing and technology.
Now,
that's why they're trying to kill the export-import bank now.
Well, I don't know. It's now come out recently that the Koch Industries is now investing in energy. They're buying energy and selling energy companies and the power they produce in Europe. That came out through the Wichita Business Journal last week, and it'll be posted at the Fightin' Koch flyer. But I will tell you right now, gentlemen, that comrades, get Brian going, that our show
comrade
is...
Brian.
Comrade Brian.
Mike always likes taking shots at me.
Mike is good
well,
at that.
It works.
I
mean,
yeah,
the switchboard has been...
He livens things up when they have to be.
The switchboard has been alive and going crazy, and I hate callers who call in and they act like they're sane until I put him on air. Only Brian Lawless from Pennsylvania has actually weathered the storm and got through my personal boot camp on radio. And,
well, I would suggest maybe in the future you put a couple of them on, and we just see how it goes, you know.
Okay. Well, I've done it before, and they that's when they start screaming, and I have to turn them off. I hit the button. That's what happens. Just for your information, CBS Morning News has had General Petraeus on, featuring him this morning nationwide. John Grant, once again, reinforcing my pronouncement that, you know, that we just do not learn our lessons in America. Here in Kansas, we just do not learn from our mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I need to the network's binging me right now. They're pinging me, saying, close the show. But
okay.
I want to do you have a – and screw the network, right? let's have some closing thoughts on the 4th of July from Born on the 4th of July, another Oliver Stone movie, and the vein of Salvador. I would like to hear – oh, by the way, that is one of the interesting things about Richard Boyle. I did not know that Richard Boyle and Ron Kubik?
Yeah.
There's a connection there. And Born on the 4th of July is largely an Oliver Stone production about Ron Kubik. And you know those people, don't you, John Grant?
Well, I've met Richard Boyle. In fact, a friend of mine from Atlanta, involved in politics, was at a party in California once where Oliver Stone was, and Richard Boyle was there, and Ron Kovic was there, and apparently he was telling them, "I'm going to make movies of both your guys' lives," or something. That in other words, it's been some time. He'd met these people, and he said, "I'm going to make a movie of your story in El Salvador." Richard Boyle, of course, the James Wood character in Salvador, was, I forgot the name of the book, but he did a quite famous book in Vietnam about soldiers sort of going against the system over there. So he's a pretty wild character, you know, certainly as evidenced in the movie. But so again, Oliver Stone had at least personally met both those gentlemen, Richard Boyle and Ron Kovic, who, you know, born on the 4th. He was born on the 4th of July, and he was disabled, shot in the back, ended up against the war from a wheelchair.
Well, you know, these are the casualties of truth, and this is what bothers me the most about people like you, John Grant, is that our audience doesn't. Our audience is. Do not appreciate these casualties of truth, and that's why I had to bring this up. And this fascination you have with crime noir and creative writing, because you, our last show together was so dramatic, really dramatic audio drama. When we talk about this thing about the counterculture, and I don't think of many, unfortunately. Many of my listeners do not get it about the counterculture, and I think this is one of the redeeming characters of our show together, John Grant, and I don't think people get it, and that's why. Go ahead. We got about 5 minutes.
Well, we should keep working
on
it. Maybe sometime we'll get it right.
Yeah, it's coming up on the 4th of July. Any closing thoughts on the Empire, Brian Lawless and John Grant? A minute each, 2 minutes each. Go ahead. Closing thoughts on the Empire.
I'll say, well, a couple of things. Number one, I just want to very, very briefly, you mentioned Petraeus, and Petraeus is no patriot, no hero in my opinion. Somebody who attends Bilderberg meetings regularly, as he did this past year, and believes in hobnobbing with the elites to formulate policy in violation of the Logan Act, is no hero in my opinion. Number two, as Webster Tarpley was pointing out on his broadcast the other day, it's the 100-year anniversary coming up of World War One, and he had talked about how some years before Bismarck of Germany talked about somebody had asked him when the next great war would come, and he said, well, I don't know when it'll come, but if it does, it'll probably be over something stupid in the Baltic nations. And it was over the Baltic nations. And what do we have going on now? The biggest flashpoint, really, is the Ukraine. And Stephen Cohen was talking about last week about how there's tremendous amount of pressure by nationalists within his country to institute a new no-fly zone in the Ukraine and to do something to help the people in the eastern and southern Ukraine. And what Paul Craig Roberts thinks he's doing is he's hoping that the European nations come to their senses and realize there's nothing in it for them to go along with Washington. That the best thing for them to do is to have to basically put a stop to it, as the British did last year, the House of Commons, over Syria. And he keeps hoping that they're going to come to their senses and tell Washington, no, this has got to stop. Instead, what happens is that you just had a big free trade agreement with the Ukraine and Europe, precisely the same free trade agreement that the previous leader, that Yanukovych, turned down. And they keep fostering closer relations, and they're basically becoming a de facto vassal state of NATO and U.S. And this is just making the world a vastly more dangerous place.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think we certainly got to back off that stuff. But, you know, you mentioned World War One. I just, the last piece I wrote was called Bad Wars and the Voice of Disillusion. And, you know, the idea of the 100th anniversary of this war. And it seems to me, my certainly limited reading of World War One and history is that that World War One was noted for two things, you know, Barbara Tuchman and all that, you know, this idea that a leadership that is vainglorious and hooked to the past, the you know, the old days, went to war with new technology that they hadn't grasped, and it ended up as this absolute debacle, you know, where 10 million soldiers were killed in uniform, 17 million plus, 20 million were killed totally, and it was just one of the most atrocious wars in modern memory. And, okay, so there's, on the top, there's this vainglorious leadership that gets the world into this mess. But at the bottom, what came out of World War One was this, I say, this voice of disillusion from the war, you know, with Wolf Owen, Sigrid Sassoon, you know, Robert Graves, and, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front, Remarque, and this idea that, you know, leaders, vainglorious leaders, the word I like, gets you into these things, but it's the guy, or even women now, at the bottom, who suffer the illogical qualities, the absurdities of these wars, and that their voices are something that we should pay attention to. And there are those voices that have come out of Iraq, a novel I cite called The Yellow Birds, and things like that. And instead of paying so much attention to patriotism and all this kind of thing, which can often be delusional, or the last bastion of a scoundrel, as the man said, but that we should pay attention to these voices of disillusion that say, wait a minute, that start asking, like, why am I here? What am I doing here? What is this all about? And those voices are too often quashed, and we need to pay more attention to them. And they're there. We need to find them, and we need to respect them, and we need to listen to them.
That's right.
That was,
you know, John, you're just on a jag. It's wonderful. So true what you're saying right now on the cusp of the 4th of July here in America.
Indeed.
And the largest and the only memorial, listeners, to World War One, the war to end all wars, as Woodrow Wilson called it, is located as a towering spire in Kansas City, Missouri. And it's an incredible museum at the base of it. It's right across the street from Union Station, where hundreds of thousands of soldiers were deployed in successive wars after that. The World War One Memorial in Kansas City is well worth your time, Kansans, to go there. You can actually walk through the trenches in the basement. it's an incredible experiment. It is not a glorification of the war. It is an incredibly balanced perspective, and you know, that I read your piece at thiscan'tbehappening.net this last. The thing that really came out for me, John, was the fact that the largest socialist weekly newspaper in the history of the United States was crushed in Little Girard, Kansas. It was called the Appeal to Reason. It started out and was crushed during World War One here in Kansas as part of the Palmer raids, and they had weekly subscribers into the million, over 1 million a week, and it's something that only the nation and the left can dream. And
what's the famous socialist? His name slips my mind. Went to jail.
Eugene Debs.
Eugene Debs, of course.
Yeah, Debs was a regular columnist in the Appeal to Reason, and the novel The Jungle by Upton Sinclair was syndicated first, describing the horrible working conditions of meat packers in Chicago. It all came out of Kansas. And I'm just enormously happy to have you on the crew, both of you guys.
Well, it's always my pleasure, Mike.
And
thanks for having me on.
We're going to finish with The Police on My Back in that vein by Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros. I want to thank you guys for helping me out.
All right, you both have got to be warmed up by now.
And the people
are right. Mike, see you later.
This is at fever pitch, so please don't back off. Let it rip a little, it's good for your lungs. And try and spit the blood bits on the floor, not on your girlfriends. Okay. This is entitled, I've Been Running Police on My Back. Eddie Grant! Now, thanks for not singing that.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.